invitation to speak. I'm going to concentrate this talk on this topic, central exclusive Higgs production, or central exclusive production of anything. I'm going to start out by explaining what I mean by that, and explain how one does calculations of central exclusive production. I'll explain why it's interesting, and then I'll move through a variety of different examples, different places where this way of producing particles at the LHC might be particularly interesting. So, main focus will be on Higgs physics, with a brief mention of stable Gluino pair production. I'll talk a little bit about the information that we've already got from the Tevatron, which supports the theoretical calculations. Briefly mention other things that one can do other than these exotic scenarios, and mention the experimental status, because in order to actually do this physics at the LHC, it requires building some new detectors. So what's the process that I'm going to be talking about? It's a very simple process. So it's proton goes to proton plus, for example, Higgs boson. So, and this is my picture of the detector. So the two protons are going, one's going this way and one's going this way, scattered through tiny angles, and Higgs is produced pretty much at rest in the centre of the detector, and will subsequently decay. Now these protons are actually losing just a tiny fraction, so they're coming in with 7 TeV of energy at the LHC, and losing a tiny fraction of that energy, just sufficient in fact to produce the Higgs of mass, say, 100 GeV. That means that these protons typically are almost totally undeflected, and to measure them and see them requires placing detectors several hundred metres downstream of the interaction point. So small detectors that go close to the beam pipe, and these protons, having lost a small amount of their energy, will actually be bent away from the beam at sufficiently far distances. So the idea would be to detect them and measure the four momenta of these scattered protons. And the two places which have been identified as candidate locations for the detectors are at 220 metres and 420 metres from the interaction point at the LHC.
For both CNS and Atlas, there's no difference.
That's right, yeah. So why would one be interested in proton-proton goes to proton-proton plus Higgs? Well, if you measure the four momenta of the protons, then one knows the invariant mass of the central system without having to measure it directly. So that's the prime motivation for doing this. So, and in particular, one can hope to get to this number used to be 1 GeV, and it's now more realistically estimated to be somewhere around about 2 or 3 GeV. I'll show you a plot showing how that mass resolution varies as a function of the mass of the central system. So to be able to measure the central system to a mass of just 2 or 3 GeV is a great asset. In addition, and I'll demonstrate why this is the case, the central system should be produced with its angular momentum projected along the beam axis equal to zero. So it's got a JZ equals zero projection. It should be produced in a C even, charge conjugate even state, parity even state. So, for example, pseudo-scalar Higgs production would be heavily suppressed. So, if one is producing new physics, this provides a way to actually identify its CP structure. And I'll come back and talk a little bit about that later as well, how that's used, or could be used. And it's clean, this process is very clean. The JZ equals zero selection rule means that light quark antiquark production, so PP goes to PP QQ bar, is at zero in the limit of zero quark mass due to the helicity preserving nature, chirality preserving nature of the coupling of a gluon to a light quark. So there isn't any light quark background to first approximation. BB bar background is not zero, but it's suppressed by MB squared over MH squared. So the one has the possibility of looking at Higgs decays to B quarks through this channel.
So in P plus E minus, you have gamma-gamma events, so-called gamma-gamma events, where each of the incoming particles radiates.
does happen here.
PP?
Yeah, yeah. And I'll talk about it.
Oh, okay.
So it's so certainly, yeah. So there's potentially an interesting program of two photon physics using these detectors, where you actually know the energy of the incoming photons, which is different from at LEP, where you didn't know the energy of the photons. So what are the principal challenges? Well, I'm going to talk about the theoretical calculation, how one actually calculates the rate for this process. Well, it requires that new detectors be built and installed. It's a challenge to trigger on these events. Ideally, you'd like to trigger on the fact that you've got a proton hitting this detector. You can do that at 420 metres, but it's not possible to do that. Sorry, that can be done at 220 metres, but not at 420, because the distance is between the 420 metre pot and the level 1 trigger is sufficiently far that that even travelling at the speed of light, the signal can't get there in time to make a decision. So one has to rely upon the central detector to provide the trigger. But that's okay, that can be done, I'll talk about that. And generally speaking, signal rates are small. So one has to work hard to make sure that one keeps all the interesting events. So I'm going to present now, spend a bit of time talking about how to calculate the cross-section. And I'll present and I'll focus entirely on the calculation of the Durham group. So this is the calculation of Cosé, Martin and Riskin, which is now implemented into Monte Carlo, developed by two PhD students, or recent PhD students at Manchester, Nico Keaton and James Monk. So the implementation of this calculation is faithfully performed within XHUM. So this is the calculation now, which I think everybody accepts as the appropriate way to proceed. There was a non-perturbative calculation which was around for a while, which predicted much higher cross-sections. That's certainly not consistent with the data which has come out of CDF recently. I used to have a few slides on this approach in previous versions of this talk. I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think it's the right calculation, and the data don't seem to support it anymore. So hopefully you'll be convinced by this calculation, as I'm going to show it to you now. So let me start with a slightly simpler process. So not proton-proton goes to proton-proton Higgs, but instead quark-quark goes to quark-quark Higgs. And I decided to be fairly explicit in presenting the calculation because it is... It is as simple as it is. This is pretty much the whole of the calculation fitted on one slide. It is the whole calculation here. So it is a simple calculation. So the process, the Higgs is being produced through a top quark loop. It's elastic scattering we're interested in. So we need two gluon exchanges, right? Because there's going to be ultimately going to be proton proton. So we can't have net colour taken. So the lowest order of QCD is this diagram here. And in particular, we're interested in the most important contribution at high energies comes from this the imaginary part of that diagram, which can be computed by simple means. So let me just quickly, I'm just thinking how much to explain about this. Not very well. Look, each of these vertices here, these gluons are. In the limit where the quark doesn't scatter through, so the quark is very energetic, scatters through a very tiny angle, and all of these vertices can be replaced by Ivanov vertices. So that's to say that the vertices are just directly proportional to the momentum, the form momentum of the quark which radiates the gluon. So that's what these things do. These are the four vertices here. These are the three. These three propagators appear here, here, and here. That vertex is the Higgs induction through the fusion through a top quark loop, which has got this simple structure for a scalar Higgs. And this is the phase-space integral. These extends here. I've put in these quarks on shell, which is appropriate if I want to compute the imaginary part of the amplitude. And then there's a colour factor here. So that's it. We can do the. And so what I've done, I've taken the amplitude here and squared it. It's given me the cross-section, differential in the transverse momentum of the outgoing quarks and the rapidity of the Higgs. and that's it. So the important, so I'm left with an integral over the momentum flowing around this loop. We're almost always be interested in the case where these have got very low PT because they're going to have to go back into protons. So if it's the case that there's very little momentum transferred here, then what goes up here comes back down here. So K1 and K2, the transverse components of these are equal to Q, so which is this statement here. Now there's a little gauge invariance argument which allows us to see very quickly that the calculation of the contraction of these gluons into this vertex is such that it is as if the Higgs is being produced of equal helicity gluons, which is the origin of the JZ equals zero selection rule. You can see that in that this vertex is proportional to the momentum of this quark, Q1. This vertex is proportional to the momentum of this quark, Q2. And then here's the Higgs vertex here. And we have to contract them into each other. I can expand Q1 and Q2, or in particular I can expand the incoming gluon momentum, K1 and K2, in terms of Q1 and Q2, and their transverse momentum. So I can replace Q1 by K1 minus K1 perp divided by X1. Now K1 dotted into that vertex vanishes by gauge invariance, and this is the same on this side and this side, K1 and K2. So in the end, all I need to take into account is the transverse component. So I have K1 transverse divided by X1, K2 transverse divided by X2 contracted into this vertex. Now since K1 and K2 are equal and opposite, the way I've drawn the lines here, in that limit, it's as if, so this object here is what one would get if one assumed that these were equal helicity gluons contracting into that vertex. So that's the origin of the JZ equals zero selection rule, and it's the reason why pseudoscalar production vanishes, because one gets the cross product of these momenta, which vanishes in the case that they're pointing in the same direction.
So what is it about the kinematics here that makes a Bajorian calculation valid?
It's the largeness of the Higgs mass. So I'm going to show you the actual. At the moment, you would be worrying very much that that's. But I've not finished the calculation yet. So if you're worrying about the fact this is going like 1 over q to the 4, so I've got an integral here, dq squared over q to the 4, which is dominated by the infrared. So at the moment, the fact is infrared divergent. But I haven't finished. So was that what you were worrying about?
Yeah.
That's that. So this guy here, contracting with this guy here, is what gives me this guy here, and these are the three propagators. So that's it. So one has to just remember that we have an integral dq squared over q to the 4. Okay. So that was explicit. We need to replace the quark lines by proton lines. Now, this is the situation we've got. So this is the gluon that fuses to produce the Higgs, and this is the spectator gluon, which is there to neutralise the colour. Basic kinematics determines that this guy has got a momentum fraction which is much smaller than the momentum fraction of this guy. This guy's momentum fraction is determined by the Higgs mass, the ratio of the Higgs mass divided by the square root of the centre of mass energy. This one is determined by QT squared divided by the square root of the centre of mass energy. And as I'm going to show you, typical momentum flowing around here, it's going to be a few GeV. So this guy, X primed, is much, much less than X. These are the momentum fractions. And in our calculation, as we have it so far, there's a factor, alpha SCF over pi, associated with these two vertices. What we actually want is this.
Can I think of it from a naive experimentalist point of view as you have to have two gluons in the proton which are within a couple of GeV of each other, so if I know the gluon structure function, I just integrate over a range of that width that's appropriate.
What we want is the distribution of gluons inside the proton with a particular transverse momentum.
Right.
And that's what this is. This is the derivative of the ordinary gluon distribution function. So it's what people call the unintegrated gluon distribution function. Now, if what was flowing, or if the momentum up here was the same as the momentum down here, this was the forward matrix element, for two gluon coupling to a proton ion. That would be exactly right, what I've just said, because that's the definition of the gluon distribution function. But it's not the case, because what flows up here is a bit different than what flows down here. Transverse momentum are the same, but the longitudinal momenta are different. This is the point there. This has got a much smaller longitudinal momentum fraction than this. So what we actually want is what's called an off-diagonal gluon distribution function, something which people at HERA have been interested in and trying to measure through various processes, for example, epsilon or JPSI production. But in the limit that we're interested in, one can show, so this is an approximation, the actual relationship between the object we want and the gluon distribution function as is measured in the various experiments, for example, through its deep and elastic scattering or IPT jet production. So the statement is that I can obtain what we need and account for the off-diagonality and just this multiplicative factor here, k, which for a power-like gluon distribution function, which is not a bad approximation, this is just to illustrate what we're supposed to be doing here, we can actually calculate this factor properly using the true gluon distribution function. But if it would be power-like, which it approximately is in the region we're interested, then one can compute this factor. It's this, and then this is put in by hand. The transverse momentum distribution here is something which we don't have a handle on, and that is assumed to be Gaussian, which is and the size of this scale b. Insofar as the typical transverse momentum flowing around here are going to be about the same size as the typical momentum in JPSI production that here in diffractive JPSI production. And in that case, this PT dependence of the scattered proton has been measured. And insofar as this is the same as that, we can expect this parameter B, this forward slope parameter, to be about 4 inverse GeV squared. So this is phenomenological, but it's the standard assumption that's made in all of the comparisons to... So every paper that's come out of here in diffraction has essentially extracted that parameter for the variable. For the PT distributions, and in all cases that particular shape works well. So that's how we're going to go from, so we're going to throw away two factors like this, one for the upper vertex, one for the bottom vertex, and replace them by factors like this, accounting for the fact that the gluons are coming from protons, not from quarks. So that's what I've done here. That's what we had previously, that's what we've got now. So these objects, these gluon distribution functions. This is that factor k squared, because it's k squared in the amplitude, so it's k to the fourth in the cross section. So the uncertainty due to our lack of knowledge of the off-diagonal pattern is actually fairly significant, factor of 2. Okay, and I've taken the opportunity to integrate over the transverse momentum of the outgoing protons. So I'm just giving you the distribution in the rapidity of the final state Higgs. That's still horrendously infrared divergent. It's going like dq squared over q to the 4. These guys, they're going like typically q squared to some small power. So there's no doubt that this at the moment is divergent. But we're missing a whole tower of important QCD contributions. This process is proton-proton goes to proton-proton plus Higgs plus nothing else. That means I have to explicitly make sure that I forbid additional radiation. At this order of the calculation, that forbidding of the extra radiation never entered. But at the next order, when I can emit real gluons, then those contributions shouldn't be present. The absence of those is reflected by the fact that there are very large virtual corrections at the next order. So let me illustrate what I mean. So this is I'm talking about a Surdakoff suppression. So this is the process. In black is the process I've just been talking about. We want to make sure that there are no real emissions. So let me give the argument for the Surdakoff suppression, first of all, in terms of forbidding real emissions. So what I want to do is multiply my cross-section by the probability that... this is the kind of hand wavy argument. I want to multiply my cross section by the probability not to emit. The probability to emit this gluon here is given by the, so this is a soft blue I'm being emitted of this guy. So its spectrum is the usual soft gluon spectrum, D over E, Pt squared over Pt squared. And these limits are all straightforward. The lower limit here on the Pt integral is determined by the fact that if this guy's transverse momentum is too low, then it doesn't resolve the individual colour structure of either of these two gluons. It's too large, this gluon. It sees only the colour singlet. And so there is no radiation there anyway. So this, so there's a cancellation below, a PT below QT due to the coherent emission of the gluons that are emitted of this guy or of this guy, and they cancel each other out. So I don't have to worry about very, very low PT emissions because they're just too small to observe. The wavelength is just too long to resolve the colour of that two gluon system. So when I do this integration here, I get this is the signal that there's something weird going on here, something important that I've missed. So although I'm down by 1 power of apres, I'm up by 2 logarithms in the ratio of the Higgs mass to the transverse momentum flowing around here.
Excuse me, I just questioned, I'm not sure about if before the radiation it's not coherent, for it to radiate it has to resolve, so then it radiates and it has to become coherent. In this case, why is this not already accounted for in the gluon evolution, this radiation? Should it not have been already accounted for? And is this an extra counter?
No, the stuff that's in the gluon distribution function is our rooms here.
Right. So
right?
I'm sorry, I'm talking
so
about
the gluon distribution function here and here
right,
includes rooms in these ladders. It doesn't include subsequent real emissions.
No, I'm talking about the red line. So prior to that, it's included. And at that point, it's resolved. It's not coherent because if it was singlet, it would radiate. So if it is resolved, then isn't it part of the gluon distribution already?
No.
Sort of like a three gluon distribution or.
But isn't the gluon evolution contain all of that?
No.
No,
so the deep.
Only, only 1 to 2 processes.
But it only contains.
So in deep inelastic scattering, all of that's in the gluon distribution function. This is looks like what you might be thinking of. All of this is in the gluon distribution function. So this is a virtual photon scattering off a proton, and all of this we would write down inside of the gluon distribution function.
Right.
But it's this guy squared that I'm. So that's in my gluon distribution function, and I'm worrying about the additional radiation off this thing.
Okay.
So we want to work out. So the fact that this logarithm, provided that QT is not. If QT is about the same order as MX, then I don't need to worry about this. Right? Because there isn't any phase space that the statement would be for the extra emission. But our intuition says there probably is lots of phase space for this intuition, and in fact that's the case because I've already, as I'll show in a second, that this degree of QT is much less than this. So this is very important. We should resum to all orders. We should take into account the probability of not emitting one gluon and not emitting 2 gluons and not emitting 3 and so on. This thing exponentiates in that case to this factor. So the argument of the exponential is just this thing. So the probability of not finding ourselves radiating photons, gluons into the final state is accounted for by this Surdakov suppression factor. The way we would calculate that, if the way one might perform a direct calculation of the Surdakov factor, because of course our observable doesn't have this radiation in it, so it's kind of, this is an interesting way of calculating what we want. We're calculating it by saying 1 minus what we don't want. We could calculate it directly. It corresponds to large corrections due to virtual corrections around this vertex here, or in these external legs. So there are large virtual corrections to the diagram I wrote down previously of this type, which when resummed to all orders generate this suppression. Now that, so that's how it would enter at the level of the double logarithms. So this Surdakov factor enters inside the integrand and it falls off faster than any power. So as QT goes to zero, you can see here that this Surikov factor vanishes faster than any power of QT, and consequently the integration is rendered finite now. So the Surikov factor actually does the job of rendering this thing at least it's not infinity. When we do the integral, we're still to check that it's peaked at QT values, because there's a tension between the 1 over QT to the 4 and the Surikov factor. So the question is, where is this integral peaked? What are the typical values of QT flowing around here? Before I answer that, let me point out that it's very important to go beyond the double logarithms. So this is alpha-s log squared. It's important also to sum the single logarithms in the Surikov. That means that we should be actually computing this guy to be this slightly more complicated object with the Alter and Parisi splitting functions in them, and essentially splitting it in half and putting half of it with one of the gluon distribution functions and the other half with the other one. So this, if you like, is the distribution to find the gluon inside the proton that's evolved all the way up to QT without emitting. That's what this, in words, that's what that's describing. So that's how we're going to include the Surikov effect, so that we can include also the single logs as well as the double logarithms. It's an enormous effect. It's well known that going from no Surikov factor to double logs goes from infinity to some number, and going from double logs to single logs gives us a factor of 10 increase in the cross section. So you might worry that the next leading logs are very important if such a big effect can move from here, but this is not that's not usually the case. This is usually this always happens, that the going from the double logs to single logs, the Surikov effect is very large, but then thereafter it's relatively small. So just to illustrate, this is the statement. So this now is taking the Parton distribution function. This is the integral that I'm to perform. Inside here is the gluon distribution function and its derivative with the Surikov factor. So I can ask the question, what does this integrand look like? And that's what this is. So the integrand is peaked, as you can see, at low scales. It's not a very hard scattering process, even though the Higgs mass is large. So one has the Higgs mass defining the scale, but quite a large suppression due to the 1 over QT to the 4th in the integrand.
But how does that? I think this can understand how the Higgs mass gets in there, because I thought you were arguing that the soft emission was suppressed by the fact that in the end you're really going to look at color signal states. I understood you right.
Right.
And
yeah.
That would seem like the cutoff would just be lambda QCD.
So the Higgs mass is entering through here, right? So if the typical QT is tiny, there's lots of phase space to emit, right? And I don't want to emit, so I'll pay a big price in the Surikov suppression. Whereas if the QT is very large, of order mh, then there isn't any phase space to emit, and I don't have any suppression. So the Surikov is working in the favour of saying large QTs preferentially emit less than low QTs. Yeah? So that's how the Higgs mass is entering into the... it's determining the volume of phase space into which we can emit additional particles. Okay, is that okay?
Well, I guess I sort of understood what you just said, but when you first put in the cutoff on the interval over there on the left, it seemed like the argument that maybe lambda QCD be the relevant thing, but go ahead.
Yeah. So so what it is, it's this log becoming very large as the Higgs mass gets larger and larger. Right? And the larger that log, the more suppression I get from this factor. So the way to make that log smaller is to make QT bigger. So there's a tension between this factor, which prefers higher QTs, and this factor, which prefers lower QTs. And it's that when one does the saddle point evaluation of this, leads to leads to this typical value here. So for pseudoscalar production, just out of interest, I said that the pseudoscalar production is suppressed because of the, in fact it vanishes at zero angle scattering, because it depends on the cross product of the incoming gluon momenta. But even the bit that remains is negligibly small. It is not calculable in QCD, because the integrand is 1 over QT to the 6 times the typical PT of the 8-wing proton squared. So the typical values here are lower than lambda QCD. So pseudoscalar production is not perturbative and very heavily suppressed. So this is just to illustrate how uncertain the calculations are. So this is using different pattern distribution functions, and the spread. I think this spread is indicative. It's typically a factor of less than a factor of two from that source. And finally, so far everything is really under control. The final element to the theoretical calculation is unfortunately not very well under control, at least from a theoretical point of view. But we, as I'm going to show you, we do have information from experiment which supports this approach. So I've calculated the probability of not radiating any particles off this system perturbatively, but it's quite possible. These are protons which are coming to collide. I've said nothing about the possibility that there can be some soft rescattering event which fills in the gap, and that's not allowed. So I need to account for the probability that there could be some, for example, an additional gluon exchange across here, which is just going to transfer colour across and a non-perturbative guy even. So I have to model that, because it is going to that will happen, and that will fill these produced particles into the final state, and the final state I insist should be proton and Higgs. So the way we're going to estimate actually the model which is the models which have been considered in the literature are a little more complicated than this, but this is the basic idea. So one assumes that whatever fills the gap in is independent of the hard scattering which produced the Higgs, which is motivated on the grounds that this is happening over a much smaller time scale than is typical of these soft gluonic exchanges. So this is happening at an instant, and these guys are not going to talk to this guy. So insofar as it's true that these factorise, that's one statement. What's also said is that there is a single, this is actually where people extend the model a little bit, but it doesn't make a big difference. I'll assume that there is a single type of event which fills in gaps and call it an inelastic scattering. And I'll assume that inelastic scattering events, denoted by this block, are independent of each other. Now, if that's the case, so there are clearly assumptions there, so I'm assuming that this is independent of this, and that the occurrences of this inelastic scatter are independent of each other, in which case the probability of having n inelastic scattering events per proton-proton interaction, regardless of what else is happening, can be described by Poisson statistics. So we're, and to put a little bit of dynamics in here, we're going to work. So this object, you should recognise, it's been the mean number of these inelastic scattering events, and you see I've given it some dependence upon the parameter R. I'm going to assume that this depends upon what the impact parameter is in the collision. So for very central collisions, I'll assume that chi of R is bigger than for peripheral ones. So I'm trying to include a little bit more dynamics through that route. So what we want is this. What we've calculated so far is this, and because this is supposed to be independent of this, the effect is going to be to multiply the thing we've calculated by the probability not to have a soft rescattering, which is just e to the minus chi, and then I've got to suitably integrate over impact parameters, assuming some particular impact parameter dependence of the thing we just calculated, which is explained here. So the effect. Now the way one implements this is see, this statement is a statement which is independent of what's going on here. So this is a statement which ought to be able to make saying it's about the elastic scattering rate in the Hadron Collider, total cross section, the inelastic scattering cross section. All of them, we ought to be able to describe all simultaneously with the same chi of R. And one can do that. That was done long before this. It was used in this particular case. In fact, this I'm describing what is a slightly simplified version of the model of the underlying event that's in Pythia and also in Herwig now. So the underlying event is supposed to arise as a consequence of one of these inelastic scatters. So I thought I had a. Okay, I don't have another slide which shows how to compute this, but the model as where one tunes Pythia up to describe the underlying event at the Tevatron, for example, then what one's doing is tuning this model, and the chi of R's here that are used in these calculations are essentially the same as those which are used, or the same as the one that's used to calculate the understand the underlying event at the Tevatron and at HERA. So I guess what I'm saying is this model has got some support from experimental data. The point is that it's typically a big effect. Only a few percent at the LHC of all our events will actually survive this. So we'd better be confident that we understand, at least within an order of magnitude, how to calculate this. Right, so having, I'm switching tack completely now and going from the theory to the experimental side of things. So, and I'm going to systematically go through various different interesting physics scenarios and talk about how one would explore them using these tack protons. I want to try to give you the impression that what's being done is thorough. So that's to say that the acceptances of the forward detectors have been included, triggering has been properly considered, all backgrounds have been considered in pretty much all cases that I'm going to talk about. So, and even pile-up has been considered, so which I'll talk about. So the problem of having multiple proton-proton interactions at a high rate, at high luminosity in the LHC. So let's start with the standard model Higgs and its least interesting decay mode from the point of view of these of central exclusive production. That's to say, the decay of the standard model Higgs to be B-bar. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it because when I talk about the backgrounds, they apply equally well to supersymmetric Higgs bosons, which decay to BB bar, for which the rates, as you will see, are substantially higher. So everything I say now about the backgrounds it applies equally well to Suzy Higgs decaying to BB bar. First thing to say about the standard model Higgs decaying to BB bar is it's in principle possible. Right? The latest estimate on the expected number, so this is a number from Andy Pilkington in Manchester, is that one accepts it's marginal, one sees six signal events with 100 inverse femtobands of data for 120 GeV Higgs. That doesn't sound very much, but in fact, on an event by event, we can measure the Higgs mass event by event to a resolution of just a few GeV with these events. So you don't need many events to be really interested. If you know there's no background, you don't need many events. So the fact that it's possible, it's certainly not possible in inclusive production. The fact that the direct production of the BB bar background is suppressed due to the spin selection rule that I talked about makes it possible here. So these numbers are going to become much bigger when we talk about supersymmetric cases.
What is the background that you considered here?
I'm going to show it on the next slide. So let me just quickly mention how one intends to trigger on a final state, which is essentially two protons which you can't trigger on, and a BB bar in the central system. The idea is that at low luminosity, to trigger, to use a single muon trigger, and or a gap trigger. So this, So the idea that there should be a gap in the detector, which could in principle be incorporated in the level one trigger, this already is. I think this is a number for an atlas. At high luminosity, one would need a muon plus a jet trigger, and or accepting all jets, say with ET bigger than 40 GeV, at a fixed rate, so pre-scaling. So both of those have been, I'm not sure which of these actually, for the 100 inverse femto bands, that's probably 3 years at low luminosity, so I would have guessed. So it's probably just the single muon trigger to get these results. Now the backgrounds that we've considered, that one needs to consider, there are three sources of background for BB bar production, for the BB bar decay. I'm going to show pictures in a second. Central exclusive dijet production, double Pomeran exchange, they're on the next slide, so we'll talk about them then. And also, interestingly, at high luminosity, you have to worry about the fact that you can have three events all coincident with each other. Two single diffractive events in conjunction with a normal QCD dijet event. So the single diffractive events is one of the protons scatters through a small angle and the other one produces some system over here. The reverse is done the other way. So there's another event with a proton coming this way that passes through, and the proton that comes this way diffracts this way. So we've got two events, two hits in the two proton detectors, then a third event which produces a BB bar. So that sounds as though it would be a very rare event, but when you've got a mean number of proton-proton interactions per bunch crossing of all around 30, the probability of this actually happening is not negligible. And it in fact is the dominant source of background if one doesn't work too hard at high luminosity.
Are those proton detectors in the trigger?
No. They can be put in if they're at 200 metres, but they can't if they're at 400 metres.
So
one relies on the central detector to trigger.
But then you have the acceptance of the proton detectors holding it?
Yes, yeah. I'll show you some results for the acceptances. Yeah, so all the results that I show you are bottom line numbers. They're after all, the acceptance of the pots, for example, after the trigger efficiencies and so on have been included. So these are the two backgrounds. Direct production of BB bar, so just replace the Higgs by a BB bar. That I'll call central exclusive production. This kind of process, where one can have colour singlets from either side, taking a pattern out of each, which fuse to produce, for example, a BB bar, or glue, because one mistags gluon jets sometimes as B jets, with something like a 1% inefficiency, I guess. And these events are distinct from these events by the fact that there are additional particles. So this is two B jets plus additional particles. And recently, the Durham group have computed the effect of gluon radiation in this, so it's a BB bar plus a gluon that goes in roughly the same direction as one of these B jets. So we've got to get rid of both of these and the overlap events. So let me show you how to get rid of these two events first. So we're focusing in on a mass window around the mass of the Higgs. So one supposes that we've got that, and we're looking. This mass window is entirely consistent with the resolution of the detectors. So this is the forward detectors. ET bigger than 40 GeV, clearly it's going to have a big effect on the backgrounds and B-tagging. And what these two plots show is the effect of cutting on this variable, IJ, which is plotted here. This is the signal. This background here is the background from overlap or pile. And this background here is the background from this type of event. Right. These events are not really cut out by this cut. This is the fraction of the invariant mass of the central system which is in the two jets. So if there are additional particles produced, then this distribution should peak lower than one. Right? If all the particles are in the jet, then the distribution will peak around one. So the signal peaks around one, the background peaks somewhat lower than one. And the overlap background is not even isn't even constrained to be smaller than one, because these three events have got nothing to do with each other. So that cut there is effective. this variable is also making use of correlating kinematic information between the central system and the tagged protons. This is saying that the average rapidity of the central system, so the average rapidity of these two jets, should be the same measured in the central detector as it is measured by the tagged protons. So delta y is the difference between those two rapidities. One extracted from the proton detectors and the other one extracted from the central detector. You expect the signal to be peaked at zero in the background, but there's the overlap background, it just is not totally uncorrelated, and the rapidities are not anything to do with each other. This background is very broad as well in that variable. The best cut to eliminate the overlap background is the cut which is illustrated in this plot, which is the number of charged tracks perpendicular to the two jets. So we've got the two jets in azimuth doing this. One looks at charged tracks in a I think it's a 30-degree slice perpendicular to these two jets, and insists that there should be at most one charged track in that direction, and at most five tracks that aren't in the two jets. So that means that we do allow for the possibility pile up does produce additional charged tracks, but at low luminosity this is 96% efficient in keeping the signal, even when one puts the pile up on top. The pile up's a very small effect at low luminosity. At high luminosity it still works. In that only 50% of the signal is lost at high luminosity as a consequence of the fact that the signal is accompanied by an associated pileup event which fails this cut. So this is the distribution in the number of charged particles transverse to the jets. And the final way in which one can eliminate the pileup background is the way you would think of first of all. Right. You've got good timing from the pots, so you know where the vertex, the primary vertex, actually is, right, to an accuracy of about 2 millimeters. But pileup is distributed. Pileup events are distributed Gaussian-like, with a sigma of about 5.6 centimeters. So you've got to demand that the vertex from the pots is in the same place as the vertex from the central detector, and that typically is not the case. So that gives a very heavy suppression of the pileup background.
Excuse me, Jeff. I think I may have just figured out why I'm confused with this third plot, which is the green is a very similar shape to the black.
Yes, this is the green.
But you've actually changed the legend, haven't you, between the BB bar overlap being red.
Oh, yes, yes. So,
okay.
I didn't realize that. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So green here.
So you would expect the
green
bar to be similar to the signal, but just like in the other one.
Yeah, because all of the particles are in these two jets in the green,
just like
in the
team. Yeah.
So this charged track is useless at cutting this guy out.
How does the pot get it to 2 millimeters? That's amazing. Whose number is that?
Yeah, well, apparently, I'm going to embarrass myself. I can say the word, but I don't really know what I'm talking about. Quartic is what
a nanosecond is a foot. So you can imagine what 2 millimeters is.
Yeah.
I don't know what these parts are made of. That seems incredible. I don't think so.
That's what they say.
Very fantastic.
So they can locate from the timing of the pots.
Yeah.
The location of that.
200 meters away, locate something. That's,
That's what they claim.
Yeah.
Well,
this is not.
The luminous region is about that big, too, so. You have to get
2 millimeters
can be calculated.
A foot is a nanosecond, right? So you can see what fraction of a nanosecond we want. Mm-hmm.
That's 30
centimeters, 300 millimeters, so 2/300 of a nanosecond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they must be able to do that, because I believe them.
100 trials.
But it's not a child, it looks like then, it's in 6 picoseconds.
Isn't it 100 picoseconds? Isn't it a tenth of your foot?
Okay, we can do the numbers later, but it just seems amazing.
this is the way in which one would look at. So I spent time looking at the BB bar decay of the Higgs, because I'm going to come back to BB bar decay of the supersymmetric Higgs. So, but the way one would look at the standard model Higgs is not through the BB bar channel, but rather through the for anything but the lightest. So anything much above 120 GeV, then one would look in the double the WW decay channel, where one of the W's is slightly off shell, it would be a low threshold. And this is the production cross section, and I guess interesting is anything above about here. So we're looking at the cross section, which is the blue curve. So that's the that's just the raw rate. So I think with the semi-leptonic branching fractions in all, I'm not sure it's over. It doesn't matter because this table it contains the numbers that I want. So this is the these are the numbers of events one gets with 13% events of data in this particular channel. Triggering is much easier, of course, now, because one just requires that one of the W's decays leptonically, and then triggers on that lepton. If the trigger PT could be reduced a little bit, then one gets significant increases in these event rates, which apparently is a possibility. So these ought to be regarded as relatively conservative. And this, and the claim here is that the backgrounds are much more under control. Again, a reminder that you don't need many events in order to do an interesting measurement. So, there used to be a plot of the backgrounds to show that. I guess it's I've commented it out. The backgrounds here for lepton plus jets have been computed, so the standard model production mechanism for glue goes to lepton plus jets, as they've been correctly included in these estimates of the backgrounds. Okay, so let me now move on to discuss supersymmetry. I'll kind of go quickly through various different scenarios that the theme is similar, in that one typically gets very large enhancements if tan beta is large, and the advantage of using the tag protons here is in that one can look in channels where BB bar decays of the Higgs are favourable, and decays to vector bosons are suppressed. What ordinarily at the LHC would be looking for would be able to look easily in channels where the Higgs is decaying to two W's or two Z's, but would be struggling if the Higgs decaying predominantly to BB bar. So the intense coupling regime of the MSSM is one such regime where the coupling to the decay of the Higgs to BB bar is strongly enhanced, and consequently it's very difficult to study this regime by conventional methods. But it's not very difficult to study in our case. So everything I've said goes through pretty much the same as before. All the distributions, in fact, are identical to the same Higgs mass. But the cross sections are boosted substantially. So this is the standard model cross section as a function of Higgs mass. And this curve here is the cross section for the production of the lightest Higgs in the MSSM, in this intense coupling scenario for two different values of tan beta here. So the enhancement is absolutely enormous for heavy Higgses, and an order of magnitude typically even for light Higgs bosons. So all those signal rates and significances are increasing consequently. This is a different scenario, but one of significant interest. This is the M8 max scenario of the MSSN. So this is the scenario which produces, for a given value of Ma tan beta, the maximum mass of the lightest Higgs boson. So it's the way to get the scenario that gives the most conservative bounds at LEP on the on tan beta. What this is so this is the parameter space of the MH max scenario for a given value of the mu parameter here. The plot doesn't change much as we change the mu parameter. It's the ratio of the production cross section to the standard model production cross section for the same mass. So I presented the results for the heavier of the two Higgses, you would really want to produce this, right? This guy. And it's been produced prolifically. In fact, three orders of magnitude increase on the standard model cross section in this particular region, for example, at temperature of 40 and a massive VA of 250. So there are corresponding, there are increases in the mass of the lightest Higgs. So in fact, in this region here, the lightest Higgs is being produced with that, but it's got the bigger enhancement. It's the same switch over as was present here. It occurs at MA, actually this occurs at the mass of the pseudoscale. So that same feature is present in this plot, although one can't see it, so that the enhancements are smaller down here for the production of the heavier of the scale Higgses. So the message here is that one can get absolutely enormous enhancements in some regions of parameter space for the production of these Higgses. And what's shown down here is the effect of taking into account the various detector accept the backgrounds and the acceptances and the trigger efficiencies. So these are the five sigma exclusion regions given the luminosities written down. So 60 femtobands, inverse femtobands, 300 inverse femtobands, and 600 inverse femtobands. So under the assumption that the overlap background can be completely eliminated, which is yet to be demonstrated, although it's certainly something which is to be aimed at, leaving behind the dominant background to be central exclusive production, the one where the one is producing only BB bar jets plus no other particles. Okay, so that's the MSSM in that scenario. Here's another variant on the MSSM. This is the MSSM with CP violation in the Higgs sector. So radiatively induced CP violation in the Higgs sector. So what would have been the three Higgs states, CP min and CP odd, are now mixing through some CP violating mixing matrix into the three mass eigenstates. And there are scenarios here where it's possible for, very similar to the intense coupling regime scenario, where all the Higgs bosons have got much the same mass. Very difficult to figure out what's going on if that kind of scenario would be realised. Now here we've got, if these particles are being produced in central exclusive production, we've got an enhancement in the rate arising because of the large tan beta. So the rates are big. Okay. So the numbers here are again at least a factor of 10 bigger than the standard model case, so that the cross sections are large. Well, this is the cross section for centrally produced Higgs as a function of Higgs mass, and what we've got, these are two different scenarios corresponding to different choices of the CP values. So this corresponds to this, this choice of parameters corresponds to this, almost identical scenarios as far as the masses of the particles are concerned, but quite different phases. See, that would be very difficult to disentangle. So this is showcasing the fact that one can learn a lot about the CP structure of the central system and exploit this JZ equals zero selection rule with CP even. It's not the fact that you can see the three, the line shape scan here. Well, one can see two of the resonances here. So the other one is probably some break in one of these curves. I was very close. And here again, we've got, actually, I think the lines are marked where the three are. It doesn't matter. The three Higgses in this case are here, here, and here. So, but the point is that these are very different from each other. So one would hope to be able to utilize a distribution like that in order to resolve this the complicated structure of such a Higgs sector. The mass range is only over, look, it's going from 116 to 130 GeV here. So with a 4 GeV or 3 GeV resolution, one could hope to get to certainly be able to tell the difference between these distributions. So these are theoretical distributions, not distributions after being put through a full detector simulation in this case. Let me quickly mention something that I'm looking at with Jack Gunion. This is the next to minimal supersymmetric standard model Higgs, and so this is the case where we extend the MSSM to include this singlet superfield, which includes a scalar member who's got a non-zero vacuum expectation value, which is generated spontaneously and explains thereby the fact that the mu parameter, which is now going to be determined by that BEV, is as small as it is and not up at the gut scale. So this simple extension to the MSSM has the possibility in certain regions of parameter space that the lightest of the Higgs bosons decays predominantly to two pseudoscalars. So a particular point that these guys considered in their paper, which they regarded as particularly troublesome for the LHC, was a scenario where the A was in fact below the mass of the threshold for producing two Bs. So the predominant decay is that is Higgs is produced, decays to two pseudoscalars, which then decay to four taus. So that's the decay chain. That can be seen in the central production, so it would be PP goes to PP plus four taus. And again, the trigger is on a single muon plus 3J, and then then one forces, so if one of these guys has gone to a muon in order to trigger, then the other three we allow to go to jets, force them that to be three jets in the event, or two jets and another muon. But this statement is only for the case of three jets plus one muon, so three jets plus a muon, and cut on the number of charged tracks in the event and on the energy profile of the jets, so standard tau ID cuts. And in addition, utilise the fact that we've measured these proton momenta, and that any missing energy or missing momentum from the decay of these taus into neutrinos is collinear with these A's, because these A's are only 10 GeV in mass, and this is 90 GeV. So the A's are going like this, and any missing momentum is collinear to a reasonable approximation with the A's. Using that information allows you to over-constrain the kinematics.
Collinear with the digit.
Yeah,
in the case that two of them goes to a jet.
So the neutrinos coming from the decays.
You said that the three taus have to go to jets. Those would be really low PT jets too. Right?
So well, they will be the typical PT of the underlying A's, which are then decaying to two taus, is of order the Higgs mass divided by two or something. So they're typically above 40 GeV.
Atlas really has a single PT above 6 GeV muon trigger.
I'm sort of skeptical about this.
I check the low luminosity. Yes. At low luminosity. At high luminosity, you need needs to be plus jets, electron plus a jet trigger.
I doubt they're going to be able to maintain that.
So I was looking up the CMS equivalent, and at the 2E33. The muon inclusive is 19, and the inclusive electron is 26 threshold. So much, much higher than these.
So the
This isn't muon along with something else triggered?
Is there's a muon plus jet trigger, which is talked about which is not. I've only triggered here on a 6 GeV muon. So that. But at high, which I've been told is okay at low luminosity, but not at high luminosity, when would need also to trigger on a jet as well. So, so I guess I don't know what the ET would be for the jet.
So anyway, the missing ET would be collinear with the two tau jets.
With the two A's, yeah.
And then one of them would be collinear with the muon plus.
Got two A's decaying to two taus. So this is what's happening. So that's an A, and then tau plus tau minus here. So everything is kind of pointing on this axis.
This requires a dedicated analysis, so you can't just use the standard tau ID because it's explicitly violating its own isolation.
Right.
Well, you can, in fact, ask for a lepton in the isolation region.
So the analysis that we've got here, this has been done this week. So this is why this has been labelled as preliminary, but it looks good so far. So and it appears that this in particular, we've not really utilized this yet, but it looks particularly good.
So for this type of thing, never mind, I think I know the answer. You wouldn't be able to put the forward proton in the trigger, I guess.
No.
That would help a lot.
What one can do is, if you've got both 420 and 220 meter pots, you insist on a trigger in the 220 pot. That helps a lot so in fact the plot I showed you before on the map of the NA tan beta plane with a significant with the reach with a certain amount of luminosity. You remember the map I showed in the MH max scenario?
Mm-hmm.
That was actually determined computing the acceptances, assuming that there is a 220 meter pot and a 420 meter pot, which gains some. Typically, the 220 meter pots have got better at 220 meter pots have got acceptance at higher mass, of course, because you need the guys to be bent a little bit more out and they need to have lost more momentum. And the 2420 meter pots are good at low mass systems. But the combination kind of covers the region which is often of interest. Right, I'll very quickly mention the possibility of producing stable gluinos. So if one has stable gluinos, which are subsequently hybridizing to something to things that look like slow muons, which would be good for triggering, provided they're not too slow. Then in that case, so this is the process where the central system is just two gluinos. And cutting on the speed of the air hadron and using these kinematic constraints from the pots to ensure that the central system is has kinematics, that's to say, is invariant mass and rapidity, which is consistent with the kinematics gotten from measuring the pots, then one can essentially eliminate all backgrounds. Now, the reach is not very, very, very good here, meaning that one can get out to with 300 inverse femtobands, just a handful of events out at 350 GeV for the gluino mass. So that's just about the limit where the Tevatron can get to already at the end of its lifetime. So I think this would be a situation. This would be interesting if the Tevatron saw something in this time. Then one could attempt to make an accurate measurement of the gluino mass with just a handful of these events through this channel. In doing this, we've made some new estimates for the acceptance and resolution of the forward detectors, which I'll just whiz up. So this is showing how the different pot combinations allow one to get good acceptance out to quite high masses, in fact, although the theoretical calculation is starting to become less reliable at very high mass, because the soft gluon approximation is not good anymore. So this is for high masses, and this is how that marries on to low mass. So this is considered up to 200. This is this end of this plot. So that's the acceptance of the pots, and that is the current state of the art on the resolution of the pots. So depending on, again, which combination of 420 and 220, but consistent with the state. So 3 GeV or better, typically. So the Tevatron has already made quite a significant contribution, although it seems to support in the theoretical calculations. They've looked for exclusive dijet production. So they've looked for this proton-proton plus two jets. And this is the distribution in the fraction of the invariant mass carried in the two jets. Is it the fraction of the invariant mass of the central system, which is in the two jet system? And they see clearly an excess. So this is all preliminary data, which was presented in the conferences last year, summer conferences. So the statement is that one sees a clear excess of events, dijet events, at large invariant fractions of the invariant mass, which is exactly where you would expect this signal to show. Now, the background, as I understand it, the background distribution is that's simulated using a Monte Carlo, which I wrote with Brian Cox, which describes very well the HERA data on diffractive production. So it's the one that produces the central system plus additional particles. So this is using the so-called Pomeroy pattern distribution functions from the H1 collaboration, and fits this the distribution. I think what they've done is normalize that the data. I've tried to find out to what how accurately the Pontwig simulation actually predicts the total rate, but I've not succeeded in getting that information out. So I understand this is normalized the data, and then this excess here is then extracted here, and this excess is compared to no, actually this is not right. I've just said this is this excess here. So this is the Pontwig contribution. This shaded region here is the anticipated rate of central exclusive digests through the theoretical mechanism I've been talking about. And one sees that adding into adding such a contribution provides a good agreement with the this is not normalised, good agreement with the data. So this is how much exclusive digest production one expects in rate. So it's actually occurring at the rate one would expect it to. And the PT distribution of the jets is reasonably well described as well. And also, there seems to be a suppression of quark jets, which is exactly what's intended. I told you that light quark jets aren't produced, so one can check that to make it. So these jets in this region, one should check that they're rich in char and butane, compared to light, and that is apparently the case. So if these data stand up, then it seems that the Teletron's already seen central exclusive production of digests at the rate anticipated by the theoretical calculations. Looking at central gamma-gamma production of the Teletron is also of interest, but I will not talk about that. And a rich photon physics program is also of interest. So one can take these guys, take photons to produce the central system. Photons of known energy, if you measure these protons. There's the gamma-gamma physics program and the gamma-p physics program, which again I won't talk about. There is a collaboration of people involved in attempting to install these detectors in the LHC. So that collaboration is moving forwards with a plan. So this is actually what the thing looks like. So this is where it's going to go, not a scale picture. These are the various elements of
They had this big low X workshop at Fermilab last Friday.
Right, yeah.
I guess you weren't there. You were here.
I was here, yeah. yeah. But that was, this was all being discussed there, yeah. So.
Are these the same detectors that we use for Alaska and total cross section?
So the totem detectors here at CMS. Right. But there are issues around. I'm not the expert. These are completely totally new detectors that have been optimally designed for these measurements that I've been talking about. I think in Atlas, the idea is to go for 420 meter. Or the idea would be. This is the proposal to Atlas. Right? Atlas has not said yes. Would be to install detectors at 420 meters, and then hopefully later at 220 meters as well. That would be the that would be great to do that. At CMS, they've already got 250. This is totem. They've already got these a program, which is dominated by the elastic and total crop, the elastic scattering and diffractive program.
Well,
and how useful they'll be for this physics is less clear, because the acceptance of two 250 meter pots is not very well suited to measuring central systems of mass 100 GeV.
Maybe that's sort of related to what was on my mind, maybe Mani's question too, I'm not sure if all that, that aren't you going to get in each beam crossing more than one proton in these from just elastic scattering?
Yeah, that's all taken. I'm worried about with the pilot backgrounds. So, but no, you're not going to get typically two proton hits. At high luminosity, you have to worry about it. That's taken into account. So at high luminosity, you do in principle
so
have
need
to
run
worry
at high luminosity for the Higgs physics here.
I've tried to present the results in a way which illustrates what you can do with 30 inverse vector bounds or a few hundred inverse vector bounds. So the supersymmetric Higgs scenarios don't need high luminosity at all. It's really marginal for a standard model Higgs whether or not you could do much with, say, 30 inverse vector bounds. Or running always at 10 to the 30.
Well, that's the integrated luminosity. I'm thinking about
it. So 10 to the 33.
Crossing, beam
yeah.
crossing by beam crossing, if you
yeah.
had the full luminosity, you wouldn't be getting several protons in these.
Yeah, at 10 to the 34, you do have to worry about that. But that's been taken into account when I've been talking about... it was actually, it's a bit disingenuous. It wasn't taken into account at all on that plot of the tan beta NA plot that I showed you, where... with excluding the regions of that parameter space as the accumulated luminosity increased. That assumed that you could always eliminate with 100% efficiency that kind of pile-up event. Right? But that is worried about. It's a principal source of background at high luminosity, but it's not important at low luminosity. That's to say 10 to the 33. So let me, I apologise for overrunning, which I did yesterday as well. I'll just leave you with the summary and the statement that the idea is to get the consent from ATLAS and or CMS later this year, and then the LHCC later on to get these things installed and hopefully install them during the first major shutdown of the LHC, whenever that will be. Thank you very much.
Questions?
I take it the 420 specific number is because that's a convenient gap between some elements.
Yeah, it can't go anywhere else, but it turns out to be where you would want to put it, in fact, so to get the acceptance that you
post up.
Yeah.
I remember Mike Albrow was interested, maybe this is completely obsolete, or maybe this is what's being used. He was talking about using pixel detectors for these types of components. Are any of these, do you know, are any of these
well,
pixel
I detectors? Thought that they were. This is not my thing, right? But I've heard them talking about 3D edgeless silicon detectors.
Okay,
so this is the people at Brunel, I think.
Stanford and Brunel. Who is Stanford? I don't know. It's probably on the list. So
I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
So it's not Brunel anymore. In fact, it's Manchester now. They've moved to Manchester. Chinzia De Vere and Steve Watts.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.